LaVoyne.
LaVoyne. Okay.
Hello, and welcome to
Based on a True Crime story,
a podcast where we will tell you a true crime story every week and then discuss the movie that was inspired by it.
This week, we picked a doozy.
Who are you?
Oh, I don't know who I am. I'm Andrea, one of your hosts.
And I'm Kelly, your other host.
And like I was saying, we picked a doozy this week. We opted to choose the murder,
The crazy antics.
The crazy antics of Diane Downs and the murder of one of her children and the attempted murder of her other two children. And the crazy, crazy movie, Small Sacrifices, based on the book by Anne Rule, as its movie counterpart.
Yes. Let's just get right into it because this is crazy.
Side note, the movie is on YouTube. You can watch it for free. It's 3 hours and 6 minutes.
It's a commitment, so, but it stars, well, she'll go over, but it stars Farrah Fawcett, and Farrah Fawcett's amazing.
Yes.
All right, so I got my info from quite a few different places. Two articles that were written for ABC News. One was by Sean Dooley, and the other had three different authors. It was Jekka Todley, Karen Schiffman, and Jolie Francis. And then also Wikipedia. There was an article on Thought Catalog by Charles Montaldo, just basically going over the history of Diane Downs. And then I watched all of her interviews on YouTube, and I don't recommend that because that is a rabbit hole you don't want to go down.
Yeah, she's bananas.
The bitch is crazy. Okay, so let's start off. So late on May 19th, 1983, Diane Downs sped into the emergency room drop-off at Mackenzie Willamette Hospital in Springfield, Oregon. Her three children all clinging to life in the back of her blood-soaked car. She screamed that they had all been shot, and the hospital staff quickly ascertained that Cheryl, 7, was already dead, and that Christy, 8, and Danny, 3, weren't far behind. Downs had also been shot in the left forearm, but her wound was not life-threatening. Diane said that she had been visiting a friend with horses in the Marcola area, and they headed home once it became dark. On their way home, she decided to take a detour off Marcola Road onto Old Mohawk Road to do some sightseeing. By this time, the kids were asleep, and as she drove down the road, a shaggy-haired man stepped out from the side of the road and flagged her down. She stopped her car and got out to talk to him. He told her that he wanted her car, and she replied, "You've got to be kidding." At this time, he pushed her aside and reached in with a gun and began shooting her three children. Down said that she then faked throwing her keys to divert the gunman's attention, pushed him out of the way, jumped back in the car, and raced to the hospital. She says that at some point during the struggle with the stranger, she was shot in the arm. The police officer that took her statement said that Diane's affect was very flat and unemotional, and her story just didn't make sense. The police began to suspect that Diane herself was the perpetrator of this horrible crime. And Elizabeth Diane Fredrickson was born in Phoenix, Arizona on August 7, 1955. She was the oldest of four children. Her parents, Wes and Willa Dean, moved the family frequently when Diane was a child until Wes got a stable job with the U.S. Postal Service when Diane was 11. The Fredricksons were conservative, and until she was a teenager, Diane was also conservative. When she turned 14, she dropped Elizabeth and started going by her middle name, Diane. She also cut and bleached her hair and embraced her blossoming figure. She began dating Stephen Downs, a 16-year-old boy who lived across the street and attended Moon Valley High School with her. Her parents didn't approve of Stephen or their relationship, but Diane continued to date him, their relationship becoming sexual after she turned 16. And after graduation, however, the two went their separate ways, Steve to the Navy and Diane to Pacific Coast Baptist Bible College, that's a mouthful, in California. Downs was expelled from the college after 1 year, reportedly for promiscuity, and she returned home to Arizona, where she reconnected with Steve. In November of 1973, an 18-year-old Diane and Steve were married. The marriage was rocky almost immediately. Fights resulting from money and Diane's infidelity, and these fights often resulted in Diane leaving Steve and staying with her parents. Despite the problems, the Downs had their first child, Christy, in 1974. 6 months later, Diane joined the Navy, but returned home after 3 weeks of basic training because of, quote, severe blisters. The Downs marriage continued to flail, but you know what always helps rocky marriages? More kids.
Of course.
Diane would later admit that she loved being pregnant because that seems about right for a narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
So they had their second child, Sherilyn, in 1975. Two children were enough for Stephen, and he had a vasectomy. Diane, however, ended up getting pregnant again. This time, she aborted the child. In 1978, the Downs moved to Mesa, Arizona, where they both started working at a mobile home manufacturing company. There, Diane began having multiple affairs with some of her coworkers, and she got pregnant again. In December of 1979, Stephen Daniel Downs was born, and Stephen accepted the child as his own, even though he knew he wasn't the father. Their marriage lasted another year before they decided to divorce. Diane spent the next few years moving in and out with different men, having multiple affairs, all while trying to reconcile with Stephen. To help support herself, she decided to become a surrogate mother, but failed two psychiatric exams.
Shocker.
One of the tests showed that Diane was very intelligent, but also psychotic, a fact that she bragged about to her friends. In 1981, Diane got a full-time job as a postal carrier. The children often stayed with Diane's parents, Stephen or Danny's father. When the children did stay with Diane, neighbors often voiced concerns about their care. The children were often not dressed appropriately for the weather or would ask neighbors for food as they were hungry. It is said that if Diane could not find a sitter, she would leave 6-year-old Christy in charge so she could go to work.
She sounds great.
Yep. In 1981, Diane was finally accepted into a surrogate program. And after successfully carrying a child to term, she was paid $10,000. After the experience, she decided to open her own surrogacy clinic, but it failed quickly. It was during this time that Diane met co-worker Robert Knickerbocker, who she referred to as Nick. He was separated at the time, but eventually got back together with his wife, thus ending his relationship with Diane. Diane moved to Oregon shortly after the breakup, but continued to write to him. Nick rejected her and told her that he had no interest in being a daddy to her children. There were all kinds of red flags that went up as we took her statement, but we wanted her to give us a complete statement, Doug Welch, a detective with the Lane County Sheriff's Office, said. But there were a number of things which didn't make any sense. Among them, why would a mother take her 3 school-aged children sightseeing after their bedtime? Why would a mother with 3 small children in her car stop to pick up a stranger? Why is she only shot in the arm while her children were all fatally shot? And even though the police suspected that Diane was lying, they wanted to make sure they had enough evidence to make any charges stick. Diane, meanwhile, did her best to compound the police's impression of her. Within a month of the shootings, her 2 children still in the hospital, Downs began giving a series of interviews to the media. First, and this is where I watched a lot of the videos on YouTube. First, there was a police video reenactment of the incident. Diane can be seen in the background fixing her hair and on camera laughing. And at one point, while demonstrating how she got into the car, she banged her arm against the door frame. "Ah," she exclaims, "I just hit my cast. This hurts worse than..." And we don't know what she was about to say there, but she caught herself, realized that she caught herself, and said, "Okay." And then another interview with several news outlets, she said, "If I had shot my own children, would I not have done a good job of it? Why would I have taken my kids to the hospital? Wouldn't I have made sure they were dead and then cried crocodile tears?"
Yeah, and I saw one too where she complaining about, you know, how horrible this has all been, and she just talks about that she couldn't tie her shoes.
Yes, that's the next one.
Ah, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's okay. She later said that people would tell her, "You sure were lucky." And she said, "Well, I don't feel lucky. I couldn't tie my damn shoes for about 2 months. It was very painful. It's still painful. The scar is going to be there forever. I'm going to remember that night for the rest of my life, whether I want to or not. I don't think I was very lucky. I think my kids were lucky. If I had been shot the way they were, we'd all be dead."
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, just, and when she talked about it all, she was just very flat and not emotional or anything like that.
Mm-mm.
Suspicions heightened when it was discovered that Downs, upon arrival at the hospital to visit her children, phoned Robert Knickerbocker. Also damning for Diane, the forensic evidence did not match her story. There was no blood splatter on the driver's side of the car, nor were there any gunpowder residue on the driver's door or the interior door panel. Knickerbocker also reported to police that Downs had stalked him and seemed willing to kill his wife if it meant that she would have him to herself. He stated that he was relieved when she left for Oregon and that he was able to reconcile with his wife. And although police had found spent 22 caliber bullet casings at the crime scene, an exhaustive search of the area did not turn up the murder weapon. And Christy Downs, the only witness to the crime, had suffered a stroke that impaired her speech and initially prevented her from telling the police what she had seen. And Danny was still alive and in the hospital, but it was believed that he was asleep at the time, so he didn't see who shot him. And Downs did not disclose to the police that she owned a 22 caliber handgun, but both Steve Downs and Knickerbocker informed them that she did. Investigators later discovered Downs bought the handgun in Arizona, and while they were unable to find the actual weapon, they found unfired casings in her home with extractor markings from the same gun that shot her children. Most damaging, though, witnesses saw her car being driven very slowly toward the hospital at an estimated speed of 5 to 7 miles per hour, contradicting her claim that she drove to the hospital at high speed after the shooting. And meanwhile, Christy Downs was very slowly beginning to tell what she remembered of the shootings. She said she had not seen a male stranger that night, and a judge had already placed Downs's two surviving children in protective custody. And then a break in the case finally came when investigators discovered Downs' secret diaries. They told of her obsession with a married man who didn't want her kids around. "We believe the motive for the shooting was to get Nick up here to Oregon to be with her. Diane considered the kids to be a burden or a hindrance to Nick's arrival," Welch said, "and as long as he said that he wasn't going to be a father to anyone's children, they had to go." And based on this and additional evidence, Downs was arrested on February 28, 1984, 9 months after the shooting, and charged with one count of murder and two counts each of attempted murder and criminal assault. In May of that year, the trial against Downs began with yet another inconceivable twist. The woman who was on trial for shooting her own children was pregnant again, purposely. And in an interview, she said about the pregnancy, "I got pregnant because I miss Christy and I miss Danny and I miss Cheryl so much. I'm never going to see Cheryl on earth again. And I just, you can't replace children, but you can replace the effect they give you. And they give me love. They give me satisfaction. They give me stability. They give me a reason to live and a reason to be happy. And that's gone. They took it from me. But children are so easy to conceive."
She's bananas.
Yeah. And for anybody that has struggled to get pregnant, children are not easy to conceive. Yeah. I won't even discuss why a woman like her is able to get pregnant at the drop of a hat. And
right.
Somebody who would be a fantastic parent is not.
Correct.
Prosecutors laid out the evidence against Down, all leading up to their star witness. After months of physical and mental therapy, Christy Downs was finally able to take the stand and tell what happened to her that horrible night. District Attorney Fred Hughey asked Christy if she remembered who shot her. She replied simply, "My mom." Downs was convicted on all charges on June 17, 1984, and sentenced to life in prison plus 50 years. She would have to serve 25 years before being considered for parole. Psychiatrists diagnosed her with narcissism, histrionic, and antisocial personality disorders. And most of her sentence was to be served consecutively. The judge made it clear that he did not intend for Downs to ever be free again. Between the verdict and sentencing, the court recessed so that Downs could give birth to a girl she named Amy Elizabeth. The baby was taken by the state and delivered to adoptive parents. The girl was later renamed Becky Babcock. Becky discovered who her mother was in grade school and reached out to her several years later. She said at first, the letters between them were normal, asking about Becky's life, but then shifted dramatically when Diane became paranoid and accused Becky of working with the authorities. She then wrote to Becky and told her she had someone following her. Becky had a baby at 17 and another at 21 when she gave up for adoption. She is currently living in Salem, where she is a behavioral health professional and mother. And I'm not going to go too much into Becky, because Becky seems to share a lot of traits with her biological mother. And I feel like she took advantage of her 15 minutes of fame and then decided it wasn't for her and decided to give a lot of interviews and all of this stuff, capitalizing on the crime. And I just don't think. The good news, Downs' two surviving children eventually went to live with the lead prosecutor on the case, Fred Hughey. He and his wife, Joanne, adopted them in 1986. Downs was incarcerated at the Oregon Women's Correctional Center in Salem. She escaped on July 11, 1987, and was recaptured just a few blocks away from the facility at the home of her roommate's husband. on July 21st.
Good Lord.
And there were cameras there because obviously people knew. Mm-hmm. And as she came out, she was wearing one of his t-shirts. So, I mean, I'm assuming that this roommate was like, hey, you know, if you get out, go see my old man, you know, never intending for her to sleep with him. But, I mean, for God's sake, you had to know that was going to happen.
Right.
Because of this, she received an additional 5-year sentence for the escape. And after her recapture, Downs was transferred to the New Jersey Department of Correction, Clinton Correctional Facility for Women, at Hughey's request. The Salem prison was located 66 miles from Hughey's home in Springfield, and during Downs' 10 days of freedom, Hughey feared that she would attempt to travel there. Despite significant security upgrades at the women's facility after the escape, state officials accepted Hughey's argument that the risk of harm to Christy and Danny in the event of another escape remained too great for Downs to remain incarcerated in Oregon. In 1994, after serving 10 years, Downs was transferred to the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. While in prison, she has earned an associate's degree in general studies. In 2010, she was located in the Valley State Prison for Women in Chowchilla, California.
That's where Betty Broderick is.
Is it?
Yeah.
But transferred out when the facility was converted to an all-male institution in 2013.
I guess she's not there anymore. That's where Betty Broderick was.
Downs' sentence meant she could not be considered for parole until 2009. Under Oregon law at the time, as a dangerous offender, Downs would have been eligible for a parole hearing every 2 years until she was released or dies in prison. In her first application for parole in 2008, Downs reaffirmed her innocence. Over the years, she said, I have told you and the rest of the world that a man shot me and my children. I have never changed my story. Her first parole hearing was on December 9th, 2008. Lane County District Attorney Douglas Parklerode wrote to the parole board, Downs continues to fail to demonstrate any honest insight into her criminal behavior. Even after her convictions, she continues to fabricate new versions of event under which the crimes occurred. Also wrote that she alternately refers to her assailants as a butchy-haired stranger, two men wearing ski masks, or drug dealers, and corrupt law enforcement officials. Downs participated in the hearing from the Valley State Prison for Women. She was not permitted a statement but answered questions from the parole board. After 3 hours of interviews and 30 minutes of deliberation, she was denied parole. Downs faced her second parole hearing on December 10, 2010. She was denied parole and, under a new law, will not be eligible for parole for another 10 years. She will have to wait to apply for parole until 2021, when she will be 65 years old. And that is the crazy-ass story of Diane Dow.
There's a book by Anne Rule called Small Sacrifices, and that's what this story, this movie, is based on. It stars Farrah Fawcett and Ryan O'Neal, and it was released November 12th, 1989. It was a two-night event, which is what they called miniseries or, you know, made-for-TV movies then. Ryan O'Neal and Farrah Fawcett were the quintessential 80s couple, and that's probably why they starred in this movie together. So there was a disclaimer at the beginning of the movie. It stated that the following dramatization is based on the book Small Sacrifices by Anne Rule. It contains composite characters, name changes, and the resequencing of events. Some dramatic license has been taken in the creation of certain scenes. The movie opens with a car honking the horn in a hospital parking lot. A nurse comes out and then runs back in for help. A woman repeats several times that someone just shot my kids and there's blood everywhere. The doctors, nurses see that there are several children who have been shot. The mother states that there is another child, Shauna, on the front seat. Inside, a woman is on the phone to the police while the mother, Diane, states that she needs to call her parents. She cannot give any more detail other than a country road and a person standing in the middle of the road. She talks about the two other children, Robbie and Karen, and how she kept telling them not to fall asleep. She continues to talk about wanting to see her children. So in this version of the movie, the children's names are Shauna, Robbie, and Karen, whereas Diane Downs's real kids were Cheryl, Christy, and Danny.
Yeah. I'm assuming that was to protect the kids.
Yes. So the doctors work on the children, but saving Shauna was unsuccessful. Detectives show up, and they want to know exactly where the shooting happened because the gunman is still out there. Diane just keeps saying that she wants to see her kids and how she feels helpless. One of the detectives tells her that by helping the police, she is helping. Diane's father states that they will go, which Diane does, but very hesitant. As they get to the police car, Diane asks if her car is okay because, you know, it's brand new and she hopes it doesn't have bullet holes in it.
Yeah, in real life, she complained about all the blood in her brand new car.
Right. The detective gives her the "that's the least of your worries" sigh, and she makes the comment that she wasn't just going to let him have the car. So on a dark country road, Diane recounts her day to the police. Her father states that they both work for the post office and that Diane had moved here in the spring from Idaho. The scene goes to a flashback of earlier in the day when Diane picked up the kids and her father makes a snide comment about having to rely on her to lock up the house. They visit a friend with a horse and she talks of them having the best time when they're together. Then she states they went cruising and the kids fall asleep. The song "Hungry Like the Wolf" by Duran Duran is playing in the background. Diane then sees a man in the road and he flags her down. She stops, turns off the car, and gets out of the car. And she asks the man, "What do you want?" He replies, "I want your car." She says, "Yeah, right." And then the guy starts shooting into her car. Diane fights him and tells him that if he wants the car, he can take it as she throws the keys. He shoots her in the arm before he runs off and she gets back in the car, starts it, and drives off. She said that she just told God not to let her kids suffer, so she kept driving.
She did that in real life too, though.
Yeah.
In the interview, she said that she wasn't worried about what would happen to them. She just didn't, you know, if he felt it necessary to take them,
right,
to let them die, then that's what he needed to do. She just didn't want them to suffer.
Exactly. Phone rings in the middle of the night in a house that wakes up a man and a woman. The man answers and he says that he will come now. The wife asks if she can ask what's up, and he explains that a woman and children have been shot and one of the kids died. The DA has assigned him to the case. Kisses his wife goodbye and leaves the room. The detective and the lawyer talk about this being their first homicide. And Diane finds out about Shauna's death. She asks about Karen and if she's going to be a vegetable or not to sustain her, and if she's going to be a vegetable to not sustain her life. Robbie is stable, and then Diane asks if she can go to work tomorrow. She says she's new and she shouldn't miss work. A doctor looks at her arm and says that there's no significant damage. And she whines that it hurts. And then she tells the doctor to not tell her dad about the tattoo that it says Lou with a rose. Lou is Nick Knickerbocker.
Oh, okay.
He's Lou Lewiston in this movie.
Oh, clever.
Yeah. The next day, the detective and the DA meet up and go over the findings so far. They go into the apartment and find no pictures of the kids, no food in the fridge, just love letters and a diary. They also find a bullet that matches the bullet found in Shauna. The detective and the DA meet Diane in the hospital as she's watching the news. The DA, his name is Frank Josick, and they asked her about Lou, and she all shyly says, "You read my diary," but that they should not bother Lou. She also states that he is the love of her life. We meet the kids' father, who they call Boyd Paul in this movie, and he's come from Idaho. He sees the children and he talks to them, and he is totally the opposite of what Diane has described him as. The detective questions him, and they find out that she has a .22, which is the same gun used in the shooting. It really belongs to him, Boyd Paul, but she had taken it from him. The scene then flashes back to Diane being upset and driving around with Boyd Paul barely holding on. He flies off, and the kids are terrified, but Diane laughs and laughs.
Is he on the hood of the car?
No, he's like holding on to, like, he tried to open the passenger door.
Oh, and gotcha.
Like, she took off while he was trying to, like, get in the car.
I gotcha.
Diane wants to see her kids, and she kind of flirts with the one detective and says that she's just going to need somebody, but she was just asking. Frank and his wife are watching over the kids when Diane shows up. Suspenseful music plays as she goes from child to child. While she speaks to Karen, her heart rate increases intensely. Karen opens her eyes and realizes that Diane is gone. It is then that Frank starts to put it together. The next day, the detective states that the story is just not adding up. Frank and Doug, the detective, they go to Idaho to meet with Lou and interview him. They meet Lou and his wife, Nora. He goes over how they met. They talk, and Lou reveals that he never wanted kids. They drink and party while driving, and she professes her love already. Diane dug her heels in Lou pretty hard, even though he says he wanted to break it off a few times, but she just wasn't having it. Also, while they're making out, she has a waterbed. How 80s.
Nice.
Back in the present time, Lou states that he has an alibi for the night of the shooting, and he says that he knows she shot those kids. Back at the hospital, Frank gets an update on the children. Karen had a stroke that left her left side paralyzed, and she cannot speak. And Robbie is paralyzed from the waist down. While they do hope that Karen will speak again, they know that she knows who shot her. Diane complains that she can't get her shoes on. The ex-husband states that he talked to the kids about the funeral, and Diane totally loses her shit and lashes out about him having an affair with the kid's psychiatrist. It's totally bananas. And after screaming back and forth, she slams the door. At the funeral, there are lots of people. Everyone is crying but her, it seems. She meets reporters outside and tries to feign tears that she doesn't understand why the perpetrator hasn't been caught yet. Diane barges her way into the hospital. She pushes into the room and throws things, and she states that they can't keep the kids from her, and she will beat this. Diane gets out of the hospital, and she meets with reporters again. And, of course, she has to make it about her. And while watching her on TV, she lets it slip that Karen was watching her. Frank states that there's no way that happened and that Diane keeps shooting herself in the foot. No pun intended.
Mm-hmm. But it was the arm.
Yeah. People meet Diane at her parents' house, and her father is less than thrilled. Her mother says something about writing thank you cards for all the flowers. Diane's mother totally coddles her, and her father peels an apple and doesn't answer when Diane asks if they think that she did it. She tries for sympathy with her father, but he blows her off. Meanwhile, ballistics show that the bullets in the gun were also the ones found in the bedroom at Diane's apartment. Frank meets with Karen about things, and even though she is nonverbal, she is helpful with drawings. She also nods that she saw the gun in the trunk, and the therapist uses the drawings for Karen to tell them who shot her. Lou calls Diane about questions the police are asking. She claims that she didn't have a .22 gun and asks if he's still with his wife. He says yes, and she complains that no one ever loves her. He hangs up, and it is discovered that he recorded the call. Nora asks if he's going to tell the police, and he says yes, because he is worried that she might try to kill Nora next. Diane shows up at the hospital, and she walks by the guard and comes in all smiley to see Karen, who is terrified of Diane. She states that she will come home soon enough. Diane meets Frank in the parking lot, and she tries to tell him that the guard needs to go. Frank says no. Diane tries to use dramatics to get Frank to let her have her way. And she tells the tale of when she was 12 and that she was abused. She states that she hates men, and she makes the comment that when she wanted to get pregnant, she just went right out and did it. Frank, at 3 a.m., states that he needs to find the gun in order to save the children. So he goes to the dirt road and is met by Doug, who is also looking for the gun. They look in a grate, but Frank states it's not there. Diane loses a court case for custody of Karen and Robbie, and Diane again talks to reporters with her sob story, and the kids are having nightmares about the shooting. Diane is back to work delivering mail and meets with her lawyer. He says that they want her to look at mugshots and that she failed the polygraph. He also warns her to stay away from the police department. And later that night, drunk Diane comes home to her parents' house, and she says it's her birthday. There's a card from the kids. Karen writes down on a piece of paper who shot her. She puts it in an envelope and gives it to the therapist. When the therapist asks if she should open it, she screams no, and she throws it in the fire. She says she can't. Frank hugs her and says that it was a big step. Diane meets a guy in the park, and his name is Matt Joseph. She begins telling her torrid tale of her side of the story. She asks if she can call on him sometime, and he says sure, because I'm sure that will go well. And Frank and Doug get into why Diane hasn't been arrested yet. Frank wants more evidence. Diane shows up at Matt's house, where they drink, and she said that while she's still in love with Lou, she's open to new opportunity. She shows off her tattoo, and with no shirt on, she starts kissing Matt. She said, no worry about birth control. She's on the pill. The day after, she says she's just...
They're never actually on the pill, men.
Right. The day after, she says that she's just oh so worn out, and Matt is very distracted. Diane is already trying to worm her way into his life. He says he can't get involved and tries to leave her behind, and she makes a scene, and he drives off. Karen works with the therapist in reenacting the crime. The therapist tells her to play her mother, where she pretends that she has a gun, but again screams she can't. The next day, the kids' father takes them to the park, where Diane is spying on them. He catches Diane at the car, and she plays on his sympathy, even though he wants her to go. Karen sees Diane, and he allows her to see Karen. They are back at his hotel, and he lets Diane take Karen for what is supposed to be a half hour. Diane comes back way later with Karen in the back seat. Karen is obviously traumatized, and Diane makes excuses as to why she was so late. She calls Lou to brag about what she did, says that she knows it's him that's telling the police. Lou hangs up on her. Doug finds Frank to tell him that Diane saw the kids, and Frank goes to Karen, but she is now closed up. Diane is in court, and she states that the dad arranged all of this, and he will kill her if she didn't do what he said. It is in court, then, that Diane says she's pregnant. At the parents' house, Diane and her father get into it, and he throws her out in the rain. Frank is reading the diaries, and it flashes back to Diane, the time Diane followed Lou to Idaho. She gives a speech about how he is her man, and he says it's over. He doesn't want kids. She screams after him, but back in the present, Frank reads more that the unicorn that she had purchased that had the date on it, had a date of like May 13th on it, and all three kids' names, that it was, he thinks it could have, was supposed to be a memorial.
Yeah.
And, but obviously two of the kids didn't die. Frank's wife's in disbelief that Diane would even do this to her kids. Frank realizes that she did because Lou didn't want to be a dad. The next morning, Diane is sleeping in her car at the post office when she is arrested for murder and the attempted murder of her kids. She says she might as well go to jail because she has nowhere else to go.
Poor baby.
Right?
I feel so bad for her.
Frank shows Karen the courtroom and the layout of where everyone will be. She sits in the witness stand and asks where Diane will sit. He points it out and lets her know that he will be right here. Hungry Like the Wolf is playing, and Diane is just sitting at the table, tapping and singing along. The jury is just staring at her. Frank turns off the music and begins to ask questions, ballistics, etc. A driver states that he came upon a red car going about 10 miles an hour. She never signaled or pulled over. The kids' dad, Boyd Paul, admits that he did hit Diane a few times, but never cheated on her. Like, that makes it better, I guess. Evidence of the kids' clothes are shown to the jury, and Diane just looks bored. Lou takes the stand, and he goes over their relationship. He said she once offered the gun to him because the ex-husband was looking to beat up Lou. He changed his mind and said that he saw the gun in her trunk. And Diane takes the stand. She states her father never gave her the love, but her mother did when she was little. She said she wasn't a good parent for a time. She said that while she loved Lou, she wouldn't have hurt the kids over it. She states again that she was abused, and this time she says it was her father that abused her. She said she never fought back because it was her father.
And she did say that too, but she later recanted it.
Right. They say that at the very end.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah. On cross-examination, Frank goes over her story, which of course changes again. She doesn't recall a car behind her, and she says that she still drove fast. Frank brings up the unicorn to ask if it was a memorial, and she states no, it was for a new start. He calls her out for over-dramatizing and also mentions that she's a sociopath. Karen takes the stand, and after she's sworn in, Frank asks her if she knows the difference between the truth and a lie. He asks her about the day, if the day was dark, if it was light out, if the music was playing. The car stopped. There was no person in the road, she said. Diane pulled the lever to the trunk and got out of the car. Music was still playing. Diane got back in the car and leaned across the seat and shot Shauna, and the music was still playing. Diane then leaned over and shot Robbie, and then shot Karen. Karen names Diane as the shooter, but does state that she loves her mom. Closing arguments start, and Frank talks about the towel that Diane used to wrap her arm, how neat it was and not messed up. Obviously planned beforehand. Frank goes over the shooting again, along with Karen's testimony. This time the reenactment shows how it all went down. Frank yells at Diane that she is a murderer. And Diane's attorney also gives a closing statement that she doesn't react appropriately, to which he blames on Diane's being molested. He states that Karen was confused and that her mind is filled with the idea that her mom was the shooter. 30 hours go by and no verdict. The phone rings and the verdict is in. Reporters ask Diane how she feels, and she says, "How do you think I feel?" The judge asks for the verdict and tells Diane to rise. The judge reads the verdict. On the first count of the first degree assault, counts 3 and 5, she is guilty. On the charge of attempted murder, counts 4 and 5, she is guilty. And on the charge of first-degree murder, she is guilty. Diane looks shocked. Frank and Doug take a breath. It's in prison that Diane gives birth to a baby girl, and she asks how long she has with the baby. Doug tells her that it depends on the sentencing. A voiceover comes on and says Diane is a dangerous offender, and then shows the judge, which sentences her to 20 years with a 10-year minimum for the assault charge, 30 years with a 15-year minimum for the attempted murder charge, and then life plus 5 years minimum for the murder charge. The judge hopes that she will never be free. A guard comes down the stairs and says Diane is in a mood, and she's dressed up like it's Halloween. She had gold pants on, tall boots, 80s hair. She says that she wonders how everyone will feel when she gets out and then she finds the killer. In the van to jail, she again tries to flirt with Doug. They have a laugh, and she says that she will make the best of it in jail, and she will be out 6 months after her appeal. In jail, they walk down a long corridor where she's turned into an inmate, and the bars slam behind her. Doug's voiceover states that Diane escaped from prison after scaling an 18-foot-high fence. She was recaptured 10 days later and put in maximum security in New Jersey. Diane's father denies the abuse allegations, and recently, well, as recently as 1989, Diane recanted her allegations regarding the abuse. Diane's ex-husband did not seek custody of the children, that as a single father, he could not care for them correctly, and the children were adopted by Frank and his wife.
Yeah, I forgot to talk about, there was one of the things that you can listen to is her interview in the police station. It's like a second or third interview, and she all of a sudden changes her story on tape and says that she knows who did it, and she's going to go out and get him.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, and I don't understand how she can, change her story all those times, you know, all of this other evidence, and then still think that people will believe that she's innocent.
Farrah Fawcett played this role very, very well.
Yeah.
I know she gets a lot of flack, I guess, per se, that like the only thing like maybe she was ever good at was being on Charlie's Angels one season, but she totally did way more stuff.
And she was in The Burning Bed. I remember her on that, where she murdered her husband because he abused her.
Yeah, she was in lots of movies, and I mean, they might have been made for TV ones, but they're good. They're not just, you know, some chintzy Lifetime movie. I mean, they're decent movies.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a huge shift in quality with made-for-TV movies after the 90s.
Yeah.
I think that's when all the good ones ended.
Right. And, I mean, and if you want to know more about Farrah Fawcett and Ryan O'Neal, I think 2020, or there's an ABC News special that I think you can watch on Hulu that's about Farrah Fawcett and her battle with cancer. Because I think this year was like 10 years since she died. She died the same day as Michael Jackson.
I remember that.
So her, you know, remembrance and kind of like was overshadowed by the death of him. So, but it's not terrible. I mean, he still loves her. I mean, even though they were together and not together and together and not together. But in the end, they, you know, were together, and he still, you know, believes that he's the one great love of his life. And
it reminds me a little bit of Joe DiMaggio and
Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
Yep. Totally. I don't know what else we can say.
Known someone like this.
Holy shnikes.
Yeah. I don't want to go into too much detail and get like in trouble for anything, but we had an experience with a woman who had children solely to trap men into relationships. And I mean, watching this movie, and my sister and I were talking about it because she recently watched Small Sacrifices for some reason. And the reason it started the whole conversation is because my oldest sister lives in Salem, Oregon.
Oh, okay.
And so I was like, hey, you know, you live in the city where Diane Downs escaped. And she's like, yeah, but she's not here anymore. She's in California. And it's actually where her daughter lives now. Betty lives in Salem. But then my other sister started talking about how she watched the movie and did some research. And I was like, doesn't she remind you of this particular person? She's like, oh my God, yes. I mean, that's her to a T. Obviously, she never murdered anybody.
So, yeah, this was a doozy of an episode.
It was. It was very long. I do have, normally we don't do podcast recommendations, but I have a true crime one.
Oh, okay.
So I started listening to Have You Seen This Man? And it is the story of Lee Eubanks, who was arrested and jailed for the rape and murder of a 14-year-old girl. And he was in Ohio. So how it happened, basically what happens is there's a new governor who wants to try prison reform. He wants to I mean, because let's be honest, prison is not rehabilitative. There's nothing rehabilitative about prison. It's punishment, and that's all that it is. But he was trying to make it more rehabilitative, and so he was, you know, trust them and let them be trustworthy. Well, he took them, certain prisoners, to the mall at Christmas time to let them do some Christmas shopping, and Lee Eubanks escaped and has been on the run. If he's still alive, he's been on the run for over like 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's about the new manhunt for this guy. It's very interesting to listen to. And there's just talk of prison reform and kind of the silence that goes with family, like family is still willing to protect somebody who, or actually how divisive that can be in a family.
Yeah.
You know, some people are willing to protect their family member, even though they've perpetrated this horrible crime, where other people are realize what kind of person they are and, you know, turn their back on them. There's just all these different components to it. And it has not finished, so it's still something that's weekly, but it's very good. It's, I think ABC News is putting it on.
Oh, okay. So. My, I guess, thing is Rodney Reed got a kind of a stay of execution.
Yep.
I signed the petition, and not that little old me signing a petition really means
anything.
Every
person helps.
But, I mean, Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a really good podcast to listen to. He tells a lot of stories about people who are wrongly convicted. The first two episodes when he started a couple years ago was a couple of the guys from the Central Park Five. And then there's tons of, you wouldn't believe the amount of stories that people are wrongly incarcerated for crimes that they did not commit. And it's insane to me that this happens, but I mean, it's out there and people do an insane amount of time before it's even realized.
Institutionalized, yeah. Racism.
Listen to that if you if you want to be outraged and you believe in the Innocence Project. That's a good podcast to listen to. He supports the Innocence Project. He not only talks to the people that were wrongly incarcerated, but he also talks to their attorneys and goes over pretty detailed the case. So even did do one with Kim Kardashian, but the episode a couple weeks ago was the Brandon Dassey.
Oh yeah.
And now how they're committed on at least getting him out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this new episode, I haven't gotten to it yet because I listened to way too many podcasts lately. Is he got to interview Rodney Reed and talk to him. And so, yeah, that's my podcast recommendation, I guess.
All right.
Jumping on your bandwagon.
Mm.
So you can check us out on Instagram at Based on a True Crime Story. I'm going to let you do the Twitter one because I screw it up every time.
It's Based on a True CR1.
And we also have email based on a true crime story at gmail.com if you want to give us a suggestion of a case we should look into and watch its movie counterpart. We always will take suggestions. Also, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. We like 5-star reviews.
We do. All right. And if you want to listen to, there were a lot of other podcasts that have also covered the Diane Downs case. So True Crime Salad has one. Morbid did one. My Favorite Murder did one.
There's a lot of stuff on YouTube, like Kelly mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then ABC also had like a 2020 special as well that you can catch on Hulu.
Yes.
If you subscribe to Hulu.
All sorts of information out
there. All right. So we will see you again in 2 weeks. And until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.